Judges, counsel are prepared to argue. Judge Briscoe, you may call the case when ready.
Thank you. Good morning. We are ready to hear arguments in the case of 19-1262 Bethel v. Berkshire Hathaway. We're ready to hear from the appellant.
Good morning. Thank you. This is Roy Penny on behalf of the appellant, and I do want to reserve 3 minutes at the end of my argument, and I'll go ahead and try to wind it up within the first 12 minutes.
All right. Thank you.
A lot of issues here, but the overall the overall issue has to do with the definition under an insurance policy of the term actual cash value. And Mr. Bethel, who owns a apartment house down in Rocky Ford, went to his insurance provider down there and bought a policy, and the policy he bought had to do with actual cash value. Thereafter, there was a fire which destroyed the apartment house, and part of his claim was settled on an actual cash value of replacement cost minus depreciation, and it's his contention that all of the claims should have been settled on that basis. However, the insurance company settled a portion of that claim, the most important financially to him, on the basis of market value. And so what we're going to be dealing with today is whether or not that was an appropriate thing to do with regard to the policy. To sort of put this into context, I think it's useful to put dollar signs with this loss. And so if this loss had been replacement cost, or RCV, the benefit that the insured would have been entitled to was about $700,000. If it had been, and that's a value that defendant's expert or appellee's expert came up with, if it had been actual cash value measured by replacement cost minus depreciation, that benefit would have been about $470,000. And then there's a claimed market value of about $100,000. So one of the ways in which the insurance company was able to reduce this claim from the $400,000 to the $100,000 was by means of what's called the financial interest provision. And that's found at volume one of the appellate record at page 105. And the way in which this loss payment provision works is, in our opinion, is you first go to the coverage portions of the policy, and those coverage portions yield a benefit amount that the insured is entitled to. If it was replacement cost, his benefit would have been $700,000 approximately. If it was actual cash value, his benefit would have been $470,000.
Excuse me, counsel. This is Judge Briscoe. Which provision then are you referring to when you talk about the coverage provision?
The coverage, for purpose of the current argument, both coverage provisions are going to be applicable, because I want to show why this loss payment provision does not apply. But the coverage itself, what he's claiming entitlement to, is approximately a benefit of approximately $400,000.
Yeah, I understand the math. I'm asking what section of the insurance policy.
I see. I'm sorry. So the replacement cost definitions, how you value a claim under replacement cost, is found at page 109 of the record. It's section G3. And for actual cash value, that's found at page 106 of volume 1, and that's at section E7. And what the insurance company is arguing, the appellee is saying, that regardless of the amount that comes out of either of those provisions, either the $700,000 or the $400,000, it always is reduced down to whatever the market value of the property is pursuant to this loss payment provision that we're talking about, financial interest. And that's found, again, at page 105, section 4D.
Counsel, this is Judge Lucero. Is the term financial interest defined? Is that the cost basis? Is that what is the definition of financial interest?
There's nothing in the policy other than the words financial interest. And specifically what the insurance company is saying is that financial interest means market value, but it doesn't actually mean market value. Where you have to go to get that definition is other parts of the policy talk about various people that have a financial interest. For instance, there was a lender on this house, John West, and he's described as having a financial interest. The policy also talks potentially about tenants, and tenants have a financial interest. So to get the meaning of that phrase, you need to go to other cases that have looked at that, and most particularly the GM Incorporated case talks about what a financial interest means. It doesn't mean market value. What it means is a person has a financial interest in the property by means of a relationship with that property. It might be a tenant who needs to insure it pursuant to a lease. It might be an owner.
So we're not given any insight as to whether that means cost basis or some other objective datum that is applicable from the record.
That's correct. And the financial
definition of valuation condition in this coverage form or
the
applicable provision mean?
Do we
find that? Well, I am looking at the definition of at the provisions under loss payment.
Yeah.
And we will determine value of lost or damaged property or the cost of its repair or replacement in accordance with the applicable terms of the valuation condition in this coverage form. And that's what I'm asking. What is valuation condition in this
the valuation
form?
Conditions, the valuation conditions are the ones that I identified in response to Judge Briscoe's question. There's actual cash value and replacement cost. And both of those, if you look through both of those,
not so quick. I thought your answer to Judge Briscoe was in reference to Part 4A, which says, in the event of loss or damage covered by this coverage form, at our option, we will either 1, 2, 3, 4. And number one of that is pay the value of lost or damaged property. We will determine the value of lost or damaged property in accordance with the applicable terms of the valuation condition. You're saying valuation condition refers back to 1, 2, 3, 4? It's like a rose is a rose?
No, it the valuation condition flips over to those two sections of actual cash value or replacement cost. And those are specifically identified as the valuation loss conditions. So the sequence of events under the policy is under replacement cost or actual cash value, you start with the valuation condition, which defines what is included within those terms. Then you move over to loss payment, and that has some rules as to how the check should be made payable. And that's what the financial interest section that we've been talking about under 4D that you were just mentioning, that's where that provision comes into effect. It just means that if there are varying people, tenants, owners, lenders, property managers, they all just share according to their financial interest. It doesn't define its market value, and it doesn't supersede the RCV or ACV valuation provisions of the policy. And the way that you know that that's the case is if you think about what a replacement cost policy is, what that tells the insured when he goes to buy that policy is, notwithstanding that your property is, let's say, 50 years old and it somewhat has some wear and tear, if that burns down, then we will replace that property for you, and you're going to pay a higher premium for that sort of coverage. That's the benefit to the insured of an RCV policy.
Farrow, again, what is the face amount of this policy, and is the premium, does the premium vary by the amount of insurance?
Yes, the face amount of the policy is $407,000, and the premium that Mr. Bethel was paying was, and this is found at Volume 2, page 255, he was paying $2,883 for ACV coverage, and if, in response to an interrogatory, the appellee said, if you really had been only getting $100,000 worth of coverage, your premium would only have been $1,255. So he was paying for $400,000 worth of coverage, and according to the appellee, $300,000 of that he would never have any chance of recovering. And the math is even worse with regard to the person who purchased replacement cost coverage, because that person would have paid a premium on $700,000 worth of coverage, but would only have been entitled to $100,000. And so what this, the way this all ties together is this loss payment section that was used to deny this claim from, 75% of it, Section 4D that we've been talking about, does not apply to the coverage determinations that are made under the other portions of the policy, because it's going to dramatically reduce the...
Thank you, counsel, for that argument. I have one other question, and that is,
yes,
there's under insurance law the doctrine of reasonable expectations. And did you assert any claim based on that doctrine?
Not specifically. What we did was we put into evidence how this policy came about. We're not asserting that this policy is ambiguous in any respect. We're asserting that under the definitions that are found
Why aren't you doing that? I mean, it seems to me that if you want to bring in this summary document that clearly defines cash value in your favor, that you would want to claim ambiguity that would bring in that evidence as parole evidence of your case. I don't understand.
Well, the reason for that, we don't really need that. It's icing on a cake, if you would. It confirms the analysis that's reached under the policy. It's very clear. There's a case from Kansas, the Coffeyville case, which says that in the...
So you concede that you're not raising reasonable expectations, but you're also saying that this policy is not ambiguous.
The policy
is
not
ambiguous. And you
are
asking us to rely specifically on what sections?
The first section would be Section G3, which is, it defines actual cash value in connection with replacement cost. So actual cash value appears both in the RCV portion of the policy and the ACV portion of the policy. And
the ACV portion of the policy is where?
ACV portion of the policy is at Volume 1, page 106, Section E7.
Okay, and that's valuation?
Yes, that's valuation. Yes. Mm-hmm. And with regard to
it's not really defined there, because I'm looking at it. It says actual cash value at the time of loss or damage, except as provided for in B, C, D, and E below. So we're left without really a definition. We're just told what it's not.
Well, the definition of that exact same term, actual cash value, appears at G3, which is pertains to replacement cost. And it says replacement cost, without deduction for depreciation, replaces actual cash value in the valuation loss condition. There's a case from Kansas.
So we come at this backwards then. The only way we really get a definition for actual cash value is to start with replacement cost and then say, well, you didn't buy that, which would obviously be a higher cost, and we then deduct and get back to actual cash value by deducting depreciation, which seems
That's correct. Very odd.
Do you also rely on the summary?
Yes, we do rely on the summary. And the reason for that is there's an exact case from Kansas. I do want to make sure that the court's aware of this, the Coffeyville case, which takes this exact same term in the replacement cost coverage and says that that actually is, all the components are present there for a definition of actual cash value. So replacement cost, without deduction for depreciation, replaces actual cash value means that that depreciation is the difference between replacement cost and actual cash value. And it's further defined down, if you look at section G3C, again, actual cash value is mentioned in it, and the words in a policy or other contract that have a common definition, that phrase can be applied throughout the contract unless the context otherwise requires or it's specifically indicated in the contract that it should not be applied there. So when you have a two-step claim adjustment process, you have an initial actual cash value payment that's made to an insured if they have an RCV policy. And by looking at the components of that initial payment, and namely recoverable depreciation, you can figure out how an actual cash value payment has to be constructed. And I'm going to try to save whatever time I have at this point for my rebuttal.
Thank you. Maybe that's a minute or two. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
We're ready to hear from the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Peter Morgan, and I represent the appellee in this case, Berkshire Hathaway Homestate Insurance Company, who I will refer to as Homestate. The facts of this case are straightforward but bear mentioning. Appellant purchased the house in Rocky Ford, Colorado for $100,000 in May 2016. He then insured the house on an actual cash value basis with a limit of $407,000. The insurance policy was issued by my client, Homestate. Just 7 months after appellant purchased the house and insured it for four times what he paid for it, the house burned down.
Now, excuse me, this is Judge Briscoe. Can't he do that? Can't he insure it for more than he paid for?
He certainly can, Your Honor. He can. The insurance limit is something that the insured chooses, and that was chosen in this case without any input from Homestate. Following the fire, Homestate had the house appraised by a certified real estate appraiser to determine the actual cash value of the house and paid appellant the appraised value on the day of the fire, before the fire, of $109,000. So $9,000 more than what he had paid for it just 7 months prior. Appellant then filed
Well, counsel, is that real? I know that's argued a lot, and I understand why you're arguing it, but is that really, you know, relevant, how much he paid for it?
It is, Your Honor. It's relevant because the purpose of this, of the appraisal, is to determine the actual cash value of the loss, and that's what the policy
implies. Well, that's really what the debate is here, isn't it, is whether or not appraisal is the actual cash value?
That's exactly right. The debate boils down to whether or not actual cash value can be determined by a market appraisal or market value approach on the one hand, which is what Homestate did, or as appellant urges, is Homestate constrained so that it has to determine actual cash value based only on replacement costs less depreciation?
Counselor, this is David Bell. Apparently, actual cash value standard precedent suggests that it can be decided in a variety of ways. is there anything in the policy that limits Homestake's ability to decide which of those ways it's going to use to establish cash value, or is it entirely up to their discretion?
It's up to Homestake's discretion, Your Honor, but of course...
Where does it say that in the policy? Where does it say that Homestake has the absolute discretion to decide which formula is going to decide market value?
That language is not found precisely in the policy, Your Honor. You look to the loss payment section of the policy, which gives Homestake the option to either pay the value of the lost property or pay the cost of replacing.
Well, but paying the value is the ambiguous question here. How do you determine value? So that doesn't really advance the ball at all. And I think that the argument the district court relied upon about the limitation of financial interest, I, at least speaking for myself, I'm not persuaded by that argument. I tended to think that financial interest was a reference to not a economic determination, but simply a legal determination of who is it that has stakes in the game. If you lose that argument, do you lose the case?
No, Your Honor, and I'm glad you asked that question. The financial interest issue is not determinative of our case. It's not the primary focus of our case, even. As I said just a minute ago in response to Judge Briscoe, this case boils down to whether or not the policy allows Homestake to use a market value approach to determine actual cash value. And we don't need to look to the financial interest provision to get there. The policy simply says, in the event of loss, if the insurance company seeks to pay the value of the lost or damaged property, it must do so by paying actual cash value. Now, actual cash value is not defined in the insurance policy, but it has been commonly understood to mean the amount necessary to indemnify the insured for the value of the asset at the time of the loss. And that principle of indemnity is important. That's a principle, an age-old principle in insurance law, and you can find this in secondary sources and cases around the country. But simply put, actual cash value policies are contracts of indemnity. The purpose of those contracts of indemnity is to make the insured whole, but never to benefit the insured or provide a windfall because a loss has occurred. The concept of actual cash value coverage, therefore, is in contrast to replacement cost coverage, which the insured did not purchase here.
Well, and that argument doesn't help me very much because replacement cost is intended to make the insured whole as well. You replace it and you get back the exact physical property you had. So I don't find that argument helpful. I didn't find the district court's reference to financial interest at all helpful. I found no restriction on Berkshire Hathaway Homestead's stake discretion of how to decide the actual cash value. So the whole thing strikes me as a very poorly drafted contract for somebody who's in the business of insurance. Where does the rule come into play that we construe insurance adversely to the insurance, or at least in favor of the insured, if that's a credible determination?
If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, there is a rule in insurance law that insurance policies are interpreted broadly in favor of coverage where there's an ambiguity. That ambiguity is generally construed in favor of coverage or in favor of the insured, I should say. But in this case, there is no ambiguity. That has been conceded by appellant.
Both sides concede that. So that's why that principle does not apply.
Correct, Your Honor.
That's a good answer for that. If you don't rely on the financial interest argument that the district court relied upon, then your basic argument is that Homestead is not restrained by the policy in how they will determine actual cash value so long as they use a reputable established method. And they used one here, which is market value, end of story. Is that basically your argument?
Essentially, yes, Your Honor. There's nothing in the policy that constrains us to using replacement costs less depreciation.
But you could. And you could have chosen to do that if you wanted to.
We could have chosen to do that, but if I could just briefly explain why that was not a good technique in this case and why Homestay chose not to do it. And that has to do with the age of this building. The building was 108 years old at the time of the loss. And so when you're dealing with a building that old, depreciation becomes difficult. There is case law out there that Indiana Supreme Court noted in the Armstrong opinion that market value is often used to determine actual cash value of an older building where the replacement cost approach is better suited to newer construction. The reason
is that how we resolve this matter? We look at what is easiest for the insurance company?
No,
and,
Your Honor.
And what do we do with the fact that we have a higher premium paid and a face amount of $400,000 on the insurance policy?
Well, if I could take those questions in order, Your Honor, the first question, Homestay didn't seek to do the easiest thing here. It sought to determine the actual cash value on the most reliable basis and determined that doing so based on a market approach was the most reliable basis because Homestay knew shortly after the loss that the appellant had just paid $100,000 for this property. That was good, reliable evidence of the value, which caused Homestay to then seek the appraisal report that it got, which further buttressed that evidence and gave further evidence that the market value approach was the best approach in this case. Replacement cost here, returning back to something that Judge Ebell alluded to earlier, would not make the insured whole. Replacement cost would make the insured much more than whole because what he had in the day.
Counsel, Judge Lucero, I'd like to ask a question. I think it's somewhat a specie of the question that Judge Ebell was asking, but this policy would not be ambiguous to my mind if the list of 1, 2, 3, 4 at loss payment part 4A had been followed by a clause that said whichever is the lesser or at the discretion of the insured. So it could be, if we read the policy at the discretion of the at the discretion of the insurer rather. The policy would be a different policy if it said that either party could elect the manner of valuation, that is, the insurer could or the insured could, depending on what the policy said. It doesn't tell us that either. It doesn't use the term fair market value to define cash value, which you elected to do. Given all of those ambiguities, why isn't there a conflict here that should not have been resolved at the summary judgment stage? This is before us on summary judgment, and it's before us de novo. We have to determine, is there a material dispute in the evidence, in the policies, language, which should be resolved by a jury? Why shouldn't this be resolved by a jury?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, interpretation of the contract is an issue for the district court initially, and now, as you pointed out, for this court on de novo review. The lead-in paragraph to Section 4A that you just referenced does give the insurance company the option to pay any of those four enumerated methods, and that's standard language in these first-party insurance properties. If you look to the bottom of that page, you'll see that it's an ISO properties form, meaning insurance service offices. It's widely used by insurance companies around the country. So I don't believe there's any conflict here, and that's not an argument that was raised by appellant either, that there was a conflict.
Well, counsel, this is Judge Briscoe. Even though it seems that neither of you want to say this policy is ambiguous, could not we look at this and determine that it is? This conversation this morning would, I think, put a lot of credence in that conclusion.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. The policy gives the insurance company the right to pay in a number of different ways. It elected to pay the value of the claim, and value is in the valuation condition of the policy is the insurance company is directed to pay the value based on actual cash value. That's a term that has a well-defined meaning in the industry and in the case law. And even
but it's not defined within the document. It's not defined within the policy, correct?
That's right, Your Honor. It's not defined within the policy. The intent of that is to give some latitude to the insurance company to come up with the actual cash value and the best method based on the evidence of that particular loss.
Well, can we look at the use of actual cash value throughout the policy and use the theory by the appellant that we start with where we see most of the definition and dealing with that phrase in the section on replacement cost, and then
No.
you work back from replacement cost to determine actual cash value?
No, let me answer that in a brief second here. First, I also wanted to say that the absence of a definition for actual cash value in the policy does not in and of itself create an ambiguity. It's still up to the court to interpret the plain language of the policy. And the appellant's argument regarding the replacement cost value section of the policy, first, that's not a coverage that he purchased with this policy. There's no dispute that this is simply an actual cash value policy. And second, that term actual cash value appears a number of times in that RCV section, I believe three times. Nowhere in that section is ACV defined. And appellant is hanging his hat on the single reference to depreciation in that section. That reference to depreciation is made in connection with the concept of replacement cost value, not actual cash value. So no, I don't. We disagree with appellant's argument.
Well, when we look at, if we look specifically at G3A, and it talks about replacement cost. Paren without deduction for depreciation replaces actual cash value in the valuation loss condition of this coverage form. Don't we get to the very place that appellant's seeking?
No, Your Honor, we don't. First, I just want to be absolutely clear that replacement that's referred to only happens where the appellant purchases replacement cost coverage, and he did not do so here. But to your point and to appellant's point about the definition, mm-hmm. the parens there without deduction for depreciation is really a reference to the idea in the insurance industry that one way to determine, another way that the concept of replacement cost comes up is in the context of actual cash value. That can happen. Certainly all the time, actual cash value is determined when appropriate by insurance companies by determining the replacement cost value less the depreciation. And that reference there in the parens without deduction for depreciation simply erases any ambiguity that's not the sort of replacement cost with the deduction that the policy is referring to there.
Counsel, Judge Lucero, did the company ever determine the amount of debris removal cost? And if you did not, how could you possibly arrive at cash value without knowing what it would cost to remove the debris? If you have two properties of identical value with a house on them, of identical value, and you present a buyer with the opportunity to buy either house for $109,000, and one of the properties all of a sudden has a destroyed house on it that has to be removed, they can't possibly be worth the same, right? If it costs $35,000 to remove the debris, then you have to factor that in the actual cash value. And without determining what debris removal is going to cost, I don't see how you arrive at actual cash value, even giving you the benefit of your argument on every point.
Your Honor, actual cash value is determined before the loss. So the fact that as of the day after the fire, the house was basically a pile of rubble is not factored into that appraisal that was performed by Ivory Hill.
So let me follow that through. So if an insured has an actual cash value property of $109,000, and let's assume it's going to take $80,000 to remove the debris, is actually insured for $20,000?
The debris removal coverage is a separate coverage grant in the policy. It has literally nothing to do with the actual cash value of the property. It's determined separately.
And here it's been determined to be zero?
Here it wasn't. It was not paid because the insured didn't submit expenses, actual payments, or at least proof that he had incurred the obligation to pay for debris removal within the 180-day time limit of the policy.
He had submitted a signed contract but hadn't executed it yet, that would have been sufficient for the insurance company. Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We have some time for rebuttal from the appellant.
And, Judge, the appellant is actually out of time.
Do any of my colleagues have any questions of the appellant?
Not unless we're willing to give both sides an extra hour.
Okay. I don't think we're ready to do that. Okay. All right. Thank you all. This case is submitted, and we will sign off and conference afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, judges. Counsel, case is submitted, and court is in recess until 2:30 this afternoon. Thank you very much. Have a